Hey you, wherever you are in the world right now, thank you so much for being here with me today. We know that we're living in some crazy times, and we know that the world is changing. So let's create a bridge as we come together, one another, in our one home as one people, and in this one world. And as we do this, this is why our signature talk today is so, so important. Today, I'm excited to bring back one of my previous guests, Claudia Balmer. She had one of my top shows in regards to nutrition vitality. And if you remember, Claudia brought so much information to us in regards to how to keep our bodies healthy, especially when we're living in a world where there's a lot of GMOs and everything is just, you know, clouded with some sort of toxins or something. And she really helped to get us on track as far as things to look for and just to recognize within our bodies and how we can harm our bodies if we're not taking care of our bodies with the right kind of food and just making sure that we're okay. So last week, I brought to the entire world a little bit of insight around how it was for me growing up with my grandparents and literally just living off of the land. We had three vegetable gardens. We did a lot of canning. We did a lot of freezing of vegetables. We ate from the garden year round, and everything that we did was literally a self-sustaining lifestyle. It was a lot of work, but the payoff was that we were able to live organically, and take care of our bodies in the healthiest way that we possibly could. In some of my dialogue with Claudia, we have had some robust conversations around her heritage, her background, and I thought how much fun it would be to get a little bit of insight, especially with our world in such a topsy-turvy way, to help people, like I did last week, give them some insight of some things that they can do on their own and just learn from our ancestors, other, you know, people that have gone to grassroots and really changed their lives with that. So with that, I want to introduce Claudia again. So hi, Claudia.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks so much for having me again. I love talking with you. It's always a pleasure.
I'm excited that you're here with us, and I wanted to just get the audience a little bit more familiar with your ancestor background as far as like where it is that your ancestors came from. What did it look like for them? I mean, did everybody knows from last week that we had a large piece of property? We had 50% of it was open land, 50% of it was woods. We had a stream that went through in the back of the woods. We used that for, you know, keeping beverages cold and things like that. I mean, we really utilized the land quite a bit. So help our audience understand a little bit more about how your ancestors lived and what it looked like, if you could create a picture for the audience.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Pennsylvania. So that's where I grew up. And my parents were born and raised in Syria. So that's in the Middle East. And that is where the majority of the things that I've seen growing up came from in terms of the way my parents were raised. I remember growing up, my parents always had every year a garden. You know, they rented land in the county, and then they had basically watered it by hand, brought up buckets from the river. I mean, it was like all old school style of farming. And I just remember as a kid watching them and thinking, wow, that looks like a lot of work. And I really wish I would have learned more of what they were doing and how they were doing it. So that's a lot what I remember. And my mom was always making things from scratch. I mean, God bless her. It's a lot of work. You know, most people don't want to spend 1 hour of prep time for one meal. And all the things she was making growing up, God bless her, is, you know, completely from scratch. So even though it wasn't to the degree of what my grandmother had, you know, done back in Syria and the way they used to live and grew up, my mother was still doing things here from scratch as much as possible, like homemade baked bread. I remember every week she would, whole Friday, make things, homemade cheese, yogurt, homemade. Every meal was scratch. There is no such thing as anything being processed. I believe we went out to dinner, maybe to a diner once a year as a family. And that was a big deal because it was like a diner. So all I remember growing up with was real food. You know, it's not until I got older where things started becoming more commercialized. And then I started, you know, studying nutrition that I realized that not everybody grew up that way. So I'm so grateful to my mother for raising us with real food and my parents together, doing things like cracking olives and you know, jarring them and, you know, doing pickles and just things that you take for granted because you think everybody eats this way. So then as I became older, you know, I studied nutrition. I always had a love of food because of my mother, just seeing everything that she was making and then realizing thanks to my high school nutrition teacher who I took the class as an elective, but because of her and my mom, I just fell in love with nutrition. I just found it fascinating that it has a purpose. It's not just for pleasure. You know, we think of food as a pleasure, or, you know, you associate it with a guilty pleasure, or think of it like, you know, a lot of people think of food and sex the same way, you know, it's like you want it, but you don't want it, right? So that's how people associate it. And then people have an unhealthy relationship with food. And then oftentimes it can become an addiction, just like any other thing, where food becomes an addiction. So I basically realized that, you know, when I started studying nutrition, there's so much to it. And I just loved it. So going back to, thanks for wheeling me back in, Kathy. I can go off on tangents about nutrition. I just love it. I can go on and on. So then my grandmother, we had spent 3 summers, I remember, in 1990 in Syria for a family vacation. And it was just phenomenal. So I remember seeing a lot of the things that my grandmother was still doing in 1990 that they had been doing. And then I heard the stories from my mother of the way she grew up. So, for example, I mean, my mother has stories of how she was the oldest of, you know, like, I forget how many siblings, I think it's 8 siblings or something like that, where they would have to go and get water for, you know, for the family. And so, I mean, my grandmother, they had to plant the wheat and they would harvest the wheat and they would pound the wheat and they would sort it, you know, and they would make flour and then they make the bread and they would make, you know, harvest the olives from the olive trees and make the olive oil. Pickle the olives, and just everything was completely from scratch. I mean, talk about living off the land. Like they had their chickens, they had their, you know, sheep, they had their cows, and everything they ate was from those, you know, animals. I remember seeing a lamb slaughtered in front of me. I was devastated. When you're used to going to the grocery store and picking things off the shelf and you literally see a lamb slaughtered, you're just completely distraught, you know? Us Americans are so used to things being so packaged nicely that if it's not in this pretty perfect package, we think something is wrong with it. But in reality, this is how food is. I mean, somebody had to process it. Somebody had to take care of it. Somebody had to pick it. Somebody had to do something to it. So it really takes you back to, you know, the mindfulness of what is food? Where did it come from? What are we doing to it? What's really in it? So it really opens up a whole new realm when you break it down. And I just find it fascinating of how easy they made it seem. And, you know, like I remember as a child picking the pomegranate off the tree and how amazing that feeling is, picking figs right off the tree and eating them. It was so fun to just climb the tree a little bit and pick your fruit, you know, like what an experience. And just, you know, getting your grapes off the vine, they would make wine, they would make the hard liquor that Greeks also drink, known as ouzo, you know, that you either add ice cubes to it or put it with water and that you drink it that way. It's like a licorice type flavor.
What so is that made from?
White grapes.
White grapes, okay.
And it's like, it's a liquor basically. And it's turns white when you add water to it, like a milk, but it's not milk. It's
okay.
Liquor. Okay. So, and my grandfather used to make that from scratch.
That's amazing. Now, as far as their house, like what did their house look like?
Oh gosh, I still love that image in my brain because I remember watching my grandmother, you know, cooking on an open fire And so when I think about how, you know, they had like a courtyard, and it's so cool because it was like living outside, you know, you had your few rooms inside, but mostly it was the courtyard. And talk about a healthy lifestyle of living. I mean, here we are indoors constantly. You're lucky if you even get to open a crack a window, because new buildings, you know, don't open, the windows do not open. So here you have this courtyard, you know, they had the kitchen off to the side, which I recall had a sink and a little area that was screened off from insects so that the bugs, any food can be stored in it and it's not refrigerated. I think it was many years until they got a refrigerator. I believe in 1990, they had one. It was just not in that room. But I mean, years ago, they didn't have a refrigerator. And I remember stories from my mom saying that they just had it in this little area where, you know, they kept the ants away, basically. So it was like covered. And it was like considered the basement area. So it was a cooler area. So they did a lot of, you know, fresh food. They basically got their food and they ate it fresh. And if you think about that nutritionally, what does that mean? Wow. You know, it sounds like such a simple concept, but from a nutritional aspect, it was picked right off the trees. It was picked. So now it's retaining the nutrients because it was able to ripen, and it's not losing it because you're not traveling to lose the nutrients. So what is happening now is produce is being picked too soon. It's not ripe. It's not ready to be eaten. So, you know, there's something to be said when you see a banana and it is rotting from the inside out and it's still green on the outside. That's not right.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of things, you know, you come up when you start looking at this and what's happening, what has happened and transpired of how we used to eat historically, you know, the ancestral way, and to now where it's so modern that we leave things sitting around forever and it's so old. Not only are the nutrients not there, but they were never there to begin with because they're not ripened.
You're making a great point. Great point. You know,
and here's another thing that's fascinating. When I learned this concept, there's something in foods called solanine naturally found in potatoes, tomatoes, eggplant, and peppers.
Nightshade.
Yes, the nightshade family. Exactly. So the solanine is known to cause people with arthritis pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, arthritis is very rampant. It is actually an autoimmune condition, and most people do not know that. So arthritis does run in my family. And I remember my mother always saying how much my grandfather always needed Advil because he was in pain all the time. Well, at the time, as I was younger, I didn't connect that was arthritis. I just thought, okay, grandpa needs pain medication or something. You know, it was just Advil. It was nothing hardcore. But here over the years, I realized, oh my gosh, we must have some arthritis going on in the family. And that's probably what was going on. So what's the point of my story? So I'm connecting this to solanine. So here, imagine this. We're picking produce that's not ripe off the vines. So tomatoes, if they're not ripened, guess what is higher in them? Solanine is higher.
Hmm.
So I'm trying to make the connection between the more modern day, you know, conditions are skyrocketing more and more. And the way that we have our food practices only support the disease process.
Right, right. That's kind of scary when you're thinking about it, because everything is being altered. And,
yes.
And what I love about your grandparents' generation, my grandparents' generation, is they did take control of what it was that was happening with their bodies as far as the food intake and what they were putting into their bodies. And I wonder, Claudia, did your grandparents have a pantry? Did they have anything? Because like my grandparents, we didn't have a pantry, but our basement of the home, we had a dirt floor basement in our home. We had a home that was built in the 1700s. So they didn't have concrete floors. But in the basement, we had cupboards, cabinets all over the place that housed all of the canned goods that we canned throughout the year. So I wonder for your family, was it something similar where you had some sort of space that you did have, you know, canned goods or something that you were holding on to in case you needed it later?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember if I saw anything anywhere. I mean, I know they did a lot of pickling, and my mother always raised us with that around, like around the house. We always had pickled items that we could eat. And oftentimes, that's what I craved. I mean, at bedtime as a bedtime snack, in the morning for breakfast, I mean, it would be something like, you know, olives or with, you know, this cheese my mom would make that would be basically, you know, it's like a form of cottage cheese. You drain the whey, you make it until it's dried out several days. It's outside in the sunshine, ideally. So it's drying out. Once it's completely dry, they roll into big balls, probably the size of a tennis ball or even baseball. And then over time, it's just set at room temperature. It's never refrigerated. And then this cheese becomes moldy. It's probably penicillin on it. And here, as it becomes moldy and older and older and older, it becomes more pungent. So I always preferred it being more of a white cheese, not so pungent. The more pungent, I just found it too strong. But it, you know, a lot of people like it more pungent. Like my parents prefer it that way, probably because they're so used to it that way. And so that alone fascinates me, because here you have, they came up with a method to have cheese over long periods of time without needing storage. I mean, in refrigeration or, you know, anything cold. So to me, that's fascinating right there. That cheese would often, it's called arish in Arabic. It could be sliced, you know, if it's hard, or we just pull it off with our fingers or break it apart. You know, you put the bread in it. You can, sometimes we used to eat it with butter and bread or olive oil. I like it with olive oil and bread and olives, things like that, that don't need to be refrigerated. And there was always a lot of that around, you know, pickled eggplant. My mom still makes it. It's one of my favorites, where she takes the eggplants, she hollows them out, and then she like blanches them, kind of like doesn't overly cook them, but they're like, you know, dumped in boiling water for a few minutes. And then basically stuffs them. And those eggplants are stuffed with a mixture. It's almost like a little mini salad of walnuts, red peppers, garlic, I believe some salt. And it's just stuffed. And then it's put in olive oil, and the olive oil keeps it, and it becomes fermented. Mm. That's one of my favorite all-time foods, always has been as a child. And think about how healthy that is. It's a fermented food, first of all. Second of all, you've got the walnuts, which are good, healthy omega fats, anti-inflammatory. You've got the olive oil that's preserving it, no preservatives that are harmful like these days. And so you've got a combination of a vegetable in there, the eggplant. So think about just how, I mean, I find it so brilliant of how did they ever come up with this combination?
Yeah.
And it's one of my all-time favorites. And I was just saying to myself this morning and to my mom, I really would like to learn how to make it.
Yeah,
you know, it's time that I learned how to make it after all these years. You know, you take these things for granted. And so those always were laying around. So I'm sure they had a stockpile somewhere. I just don't recall where.
That's fascinating, because one of the things that really was key in what you said was the olive oil is what was used to preserve the food. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. So just, you know, these different cultures and the way that they're, you know, if you go back to the grassroots, like the way that they're able to preserve food and hold on to it for however long. I know last week, one of the things that I had talked about was some of the food and longevity of food, and just what are some of those key items that can sustain for years and years and years. Because if you're in a wartime situation and your country's going, you know, or is at war, it's really important that you do have some sort of idea of what it is that you can eat that is safe for you and is okay for you. We always had dried herbs in our basement as well. Was that something that was part of your family?
Oh, that's
your lifestyle.
I'm so glad you brought that up. We ate tons of herbs. I remember just eating mint with olives as a snack at bedtime, and it was so delicious. I love it. We eat so many herbs. I mean, garlic and onions and mint and parsley and oregano and basil. I mean, every mint you could think of, you know. And actually, you reminded me about this, which I have some to, you know, here with me. It's called za'atar, which is a Middle Eastern combination of seasonings and spices, sesame seeds, thyme, and sumac. My mom told me that there's, or she puts at least ground chickpeas in it. So there's protein right there and fiber. And the thyme is fabulous. I mean, listen to this combination. So we used to eat it when we were sick, when we had a stomach ache. It's like instant medicine. It keeps at room temperature because it's basically like a dried seasoning spice rub, you know. And the thyme is antibacterial, antiviral, anti-yeast and fungus. I mean, this is medicine, you know. And now I'll just sprinkle it on a salad and it gives instant flavoring.
That's incredible. And I love the beneficial properties that it has for the body, because there's so much that people aren't aware of, these natural herbs that can actually heal us, especially when there's a lot of confusion around what is actually healing and what's not healing. And a lot of people have gone, you know, just to the doctor just to heal their bodies and get a prescription. But in reality, we have been designed to be healed with Mother Earth's, you know, properties of whatever it is that is available to us. I mean, we really are perfectly designed to be healed like that. So I love that you're bringing this to light for us as well. One of the things that I wanted to ask you too, because one of the topics that I had talked about last week in my show was the medicinal plants. And to your point, because we were just talking about it, did your family use anything that was helpful as far as, you know, medicine and helping people in your family?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I'd love to know the answer to that. If I can go back in time and interview my grandmother, I'd love to talk to her about it. Maybe I'll have to ask my mom some of these questions. I mean, I know growing up, my mom would always say to me, come eat this. This is good for you. Or when we had a stomach ache, she would give us mint tea. So as I got older, I always associated mint tea with having a stomach ache and really didn't prefer it if I had a choice of tea. So, and she's right on. Mint is good for stomach aches. You know, ginger is good for stomach aches. So there's a lot of these healing properties. Like you said, oregano is also like the cousin of thyme. So it's also antiviral, antibacterial, anti-yeast and fungus. So a lot of times, I don't know if they purposefully did this or not, but they were so brilliant and naturally they used these things. So they likely didn't have any of these issues that we now have in modern day society because they use these daily on a daily basis. I mean, za'atar is a staple. I mean, it's something when you ask about the pantry, that's always in the pantry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you dip bread in the olive oil and the za'atar and you eat it, and you can eat it with cucumbers, tomatoes, onions, fresh onions from the garden, whatever there was available, olives, delicious. Till this day, I love that. And so it's just, I try to avoid eating a lot of bread. So right now, you know, that's not something I'm eating, but I'll sprinkle it on whatever I can. So I'm sure they knew about it, but I don't really know the details of how they used what for what purposes. Just because all they did was medicinal. I mean, you think about the yogurt, the fermented foods. You know, now we know that when you populate the gut with healthy bacteria, it doesn't give space for the bad stuff to grow. So think about that for a minute. Now, the olden days, it was just normal to pickle stuff. It was just part of, like you said, stock the pantry. Be ready for, you know, the winter. You know, you take all your stuff in the summertime, you harvest it and you pack it all up and you pickle it. Well, that was just normal. Now think about where we are today. Most people don't eat anything pickled. I mean, if they do, they're making a point to eat it. It's not because it was preserved in a pickling way. That's the whole idea behind pickling. It was a method of preservation, food preservation.
Yeah, absolutely. And just things like sauerkraut. My grandfather used to make sauerkraut, homemade sauerkraut, and it would ferment in, you know, down in the basement again. You know, we had the dirt floor, but he had this bucket that the cabbage would sit in. And it was always, you know, something that was very intriguing because it's like, what is that? Like, what is going on there? But I mean, honestly, it was the best sauerkraut I think I've ever had in my entire life because it was just, you know, very, it was done just right. And it was very, very good in the sense that it was from the garden. It was from our garden and he did it. You know, it's just, there was so much love put into it and it was just wonderful. And I think that's part of what made, you know, my experience so wonderful too, because you felt what was put into it, and it was, you know, it was really awesome.
Isn't that the truth? That's a great point you bring up though. You know, people, when they used to take their time creating things from the heart, and now we just rush. And I know for myself, when I rush to throw something together, it tastes like I rushed it and threw it together. There's no love in it.
Yeah. So true though. So true. So one of the things there's a couple of things that I wanted to highlight during our show together. One of the things that we were talking about earlier is just some foods that will last for a long period of time. So somewhere in the world right now, especially with, you know, recent developments and the way the world is changing with, you know, fighting or whatever, wartime, whatever, in different countries. I thought it would be a good idea just to educate the audience a little bit around some of the foods that do last a long time. So I have a list that if anybody is listening and they want to take notes, you know, please write these things down. So these are foods that will last you for many, many years. One article I read was 27 years, but I'm saying many, many years because I know a lot of these foods were in my pantry or, you know, downstairs in the basement. And that wasn't all of them, but I'm going to highlight the whole list for you basically so that you have something to go from. So for me, I mean, we always had apple cider vinegar in our stockpile. We always had baking soda. Again, all of these foods I'm mentioning will last years and years and years. Bouillon cubes. That's something I always remember my grandmother having. And I always thought, why in the world are there so many bouillon cubes? But, you know, when you think about it, if you're in hard times and that's something that lasts for years and years and years, I mean, that's something easy to make soup with. So bouillon cubes, cocoa, cornstarch, corn syrup, always, always, always have dried beans. You always want to have dried corn. Hardtack is the recipe that I gave everyone last week in my show. That's the one that you create a bread, and actually during World War II, a lot of the soldiers carried that with them. And it's something very easy that you can make from home. So if you didn't catch my show last week, you might want to listen to that show and get the recipe for that. Of course, honey will last for years and years. Coffee, maple syrup, rolled oats, salt, soy sauce, sugar, tea, vanilla extract, rice, white rice that is. Brown rice will not last as long, so it has to be white rice. White vinegar, whole wheat grains, and just going back to a couple of items, these weren't in our arsenal of food that we kept on hand, but in today's world, they're added to the list. So those would be potato flakes, ramen noodles, and pasta. So pasta was not something we ever ate when I was growing up, but today we do have that available to us. So those foods in particular will last you a long time for your pantry. A variety of these foods also, you can kind of mix them up a little bit to create some sort of creations of sorts. And the other thing too, that I think most people already know will last a really long time is alcohol. So alcohol of various sorts that will last a long time. Now, one of the things that I think is important besides, you know, the canning and the freezing of vegetables and the things that we were just talking about with Claudia is also some of these other items that we may need to have on hand. So last week I gave everyone a recipe for a do-it-yourself washing soap that you can use for laundry and washing your clothes. And this is something that I've used for years and years. I actually sat down and calculated at one point how much money I was spending just in laundry soap, and it was close to $1,000 a year. And I was able to pull that back to $25 a year. So to say the least, you know, saving almost $1,000 on just laundry soap is incredible. And what a lot of people don't realize is that by making your own soap. I mean, it's actually super, super easy. And if you have sensitive skin, I mean, you can customize it to accommodate your sensitive skin. If you want it to smell a certain way, you could put essential oils into your laundry soap. I mean, there's so many things that you can do to be creative, but it will really, really cut your expenses back quite a bit. And I know a lot of people are struggling financially because everything is escalating through the roof as far as the cost of goods and services, which is why this is so, so important to put out into the world, because we really need to help people get a handle on how to cut back on their cost of what it is that they're spending on food and other things. The other thing that I also wanted to talk about is, and this came to my attention very recently, which I thought, wow, like I didn't even know this. So here, if you are buying produce and you have stickers on your produce, and listen to this, this is really interesting. So I know growing up when I would go to the grocery and I'd buy my bananas, I always had a sticker on the bananas that had 4011. And back in the day, I actually worked as a cashier in a grocery store. So that's always been embedded in my brain because I had to physically type in 4011 every time someone would buy bananas. So to this day, if you go to the grocery store and you pick up a bundle of bananas, you'll see a sticker and it will say 4011. And that is the 4-digit code that identifies the bananas. Now, more recently, we have been introduced to more organic produce and vegetables. And the organic code will start with a number 9. It will be a 5-digit code, but it will start with number 9. So keep in mind the conventionally grown produce, fruit, vegetables, whatever, those are only 4-digit codes. So it will start with a 3, or it will start with a 4, like I suggested with the bananas, 4011. And more recently with the organic food, it's a 5-digit code and it starts with number 9. Now, what you may not know is if your produce or your vegetables are genetically modified, and listen to what I'm about to say, if they're genetically modified, they're going to start with the number 8. It will be a 5-digit code, but it will start with the number 8. So keep in mind what it is that you're buying. If it's genetically modified, it starts with 8. So we want to stick to the organic foods. We want to stick to foods that we know where they're coming from, so we know what we're putting into our body. So please know your labels. Please know what you're buying. And please be vigilant in regards to what it is you're doing with your health, which is going to bring me to my next conversation with Claudia here, because Claudia and I were talking about the size of your body, right? So we were having this little conversation around what size clothes do you wear? What size, you know, pants, shirts, whatever, what size do you wear? And Claudia, what did you say to me?
Well, have you heard of size inflation? You said, what?
I have no idea what size inflation is. Of course, we know of economic inflation, which is part of the reason we're having this conversation today. But whoa, back up. So what in the world is size inflation? Explain that to us.
So that's exactly what I thought when I heard it back in college when it was presented to us and I learned about it. I thought, this is odd. I've heard of economic inflation, but what in the world is size inflation? So Marilyn Monroe, many people know her because she's an iconic figure in the U.S. From when it was it back in the 50s. So she supposedly was a size 12 at the time, but with size inflation and at the time of when I learned this, which was already, you know, has already been like, gosh, I'm dating myself here, but when did I learn this? It would have been 20 some years ago. At the time, she would have been maybe a size 8, but when she was alive, she was a size 12. So over the years, the sizes have changed to accommodate those larger sizes that people need because people are getting bigger. which opens up a whole other can of worms. So then you ask, well, why is that happening? So if you look at it, there's a lot. Now, a lot is affected because of economy. Economics drives food and nutrition. So this takes us into probably a whole other episode. So I don't even know if you want me to open up that can of worms. But so over the years, there's been size inflation. So what that means is if you think about what size you used to wear years ago and what size you wear now, you likely wear a smaller size, but you think, whoa, I didn't think it was smaller. I thought it was actually bigger. So oftentimes that's what happens. And if you go across the board, I don't see consistency in sizing. I mean, I have seen, you know, what I bought a pair of pants in size 2 when they're clearly not a 2 and they're probably what I would call a 6 or an 8.
Isn't it crazy? Because I'm, you know, I was thinking about this very topic and I started to think about my wardrobe and literally my wardrobe is all different sizes. It's not consistent. Unless I'm sticking to the same exact branding, then maybe there's a little bit of consistency, but even then it's not consistent because depending on when I purchased an item, you can literally see and feel the shift to your point exactly. So when you told me about size inflation, it actually made me upset a little bit because it like made me really recognize that all they're doing is trying to make you feel better.
Yes. And why is that? So people keep buying because when people feel better, they buy more. And when people feel bad, they don't want to shop. So the downside to that is there's such a thing as shop therapy, which just makes you feel worse when, you know, the bill comes in. So it could be a vicious cycle, just like eating, you know? So what is the moral story? We really need to go back to roots, you know, it goes back to healthy living. It keeps going back to that. And you know, like we talked about in the first episode where you had me on, what does that look like? Well, you know, let's try to eat real food. Like Dr. Hyman says, you know, does it come in nature? If you find it in nature, it's real food. If you can't find it in nature, it's not real food. So there's so many now, you know, conditions that are skyrocketing. I mean, it's just so prevalent that people don't even link their diet to their health condition when most cases, I would say not, if I were to take a guess, 90%, unless they're genetic conditions, which diet could still help, you know, 90% of conditions would be my guess could be supported through diet, if not 100%. You can't prevent everything. Some things are genetic, but, you know, in most cases, the diet can help a lot of conditions. So I think we need to go back to our roots, back to the basics, you know, eat real food, get rid of all the processed stuff. I mean, and that's the other thing that drove the processed foods. Now, if we're going back and this, let me know if you want to save this for another episode, because it kind of all does tie in. You know, when we talk about economics, these foods were created to increase longevity on the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is when it all started, World War II. And then the, when they wanted to keep foods longer, women went to work. Women start to work to support everybody because the husbands were at war. So what happened was when they started increasing the processed foods and women went to work, obesity rates start to skyrocket. Preservatives were being added to foods, so foods last longer. So that's when really everything started going downhill, is with the Industrial Revolution. It's quite ironic, I think.
Yeah. And how many of the foods that we see on the shelves today have this, I don't know, some sort of additive or something that makes you crave it or you want more and more of it, or, you know, there's almost like this addictive kind of feel to it. But you don't get that when you're eating real food. When you're eating real food, your body is definitely feeling good because it's, you know, got the real stuff. But when you're eating the junk food, like your body wants more and more and it's not sustained. It doesn't make you feel good. You get the fog in the brain, you get the inflammation, you just don't feel good.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I've seen it with myself and, you know, my son and other people I've worked with where, you know, we get on an anti-inflammatory diet that's specific to their body. We get rid of all the foods causing them inflammation. They are so shocked that within several days, their cravings completely disappear.
Yep.
And they're full. They just don't need to eat as much. You know, they're satisfied with their meals and they can't believe that they're eating real food and actually feel satisfied. Where, like you said before, you know, with eating all those foods, it just made them crave it more. And the other thing that, you know, talking about economics that I have found interesting is the foods that were the cheapest to produce and then as a result put into every single item, because they were able to pump it out and feed a lot of the population cheaply, including, you know, ship it to wherever it had to be shipped, are those same things and that, you know, are highly foods that people are highly reactive to, and I, including me. So these are wheat, which is practically in everything, you know, wheat, soy, corn, and dairy. You know, cow's milk. So these are the things that are basically in everything. They're very invasive in the food supply. Those are usually the cheap things to produce. So they've been pumped into everything, hence the corn syrup, all the, you know, corn derivatives. I mean, I was floored when I found that citric acid, which is an ingredient in a lot of things, may not be coming from citrus fruits. Actually, it usually doesn't come from citrus fruits because it's so expensive to get. It usually comes from corn.
Wow. Wow. I feel like there's so much that we don't even know about what we're actually putting into our bodies.
You're absolutely right. And that's why, you know, I'm always floored when the more I learn, it's not a surprise anymore why people are so sick. And, you know, in the U.S., you know, people are walking around every year, if not let alone every decade, but every year, bigger and bigger and bigger. And people think there is an obesity issue. It's an inflammatory issue. The real pandemic is inflammation causing the obesity. That's driving the obesity. That's driving the infertility. That's driving all those factors. And because of our food supply, it's got to start in our food supply. There's a lot that can be done, but why isn't it not being done? It all goes back to economics.
Right, right. And it's a serious concern because when you think about it, like as you're moving forward and the cost of food is rising at rapid paces and people may or may not be able to keep up as far as what they can afford, right? So can you, I don't know if you have any insight on this, but in case there's someone listening who may be affected by this. And, you know, part of the reason I'm asking this question is because I've been there. I was a single mom with three kids living off of a, you know, a set dollar amount that I needed to pay my rent. I needed to pay my utilities, you know, whatever it is I had. And honestly, things like when things like food start escalating, it does really, really impact your ability to buy the quantity that you would normally get, right? Which is a real concern for a lot of families. Do you have any kind of quick hit items that people can still keep within their budget, even if the costs are going up, but still be able to feed their family and have them feel sustained where they're, you know, where they're not going hungry to the degree that they may have if they were buying the junk food? Because as we just said, the junk food is going to, even though it is cheaper in price, you're going to keep eating more, you're going to eat double the amount or triple the amount, whatever, of that junk food because it's not doing what the body needs it to do.
Absolutely. So historically, not only in the U.S., but in every culture, historically, beans and rice are a staple. Every culture you look at has some form of beans and rice they use. And if it's not rice, it's another form of grain. So whatever grain is available, like, for example, we did eat rice growing up, but we also ate bulgur. Bulgur is a wheat or other, you know, there's other forms of the wheat, you know, because it was readily available. I mean, it was from scratch half the time. But anyway, as many cultures usually have some form of grain, or if rice is usually cheap, and beans. Now, when you combine a bean with a grain, what do you get? Now, I love this. You get a complete protein. What does that mean? Well, a complete protein is something like eggs. That's historically been known as the cheapest form of a complete protein. So eggs, I know a lot of people are raising chickens now. I know you've got yourself some mother hens.
I've got mine.
So I've got neighbors who are raising chickens. So, you know, having chickens, if you're not, you know, you don't have a food allergy or sensitivity to it, that could be a fabulous way to get, you know, some good protein in. They're very diverse. You can use them for many things. So combining, going back to, if you don't have that, then your beans and rice combination are a great source of complete protein. Our bodies need different amino acids to make building blocks. People don't realize, you know, it used to be thought that in the developed world, you know, AKA USA and other developed countries, we don't have this problem of protein deficiency because, you know, it was always thought of as like something that happens just in Africa. But now as time goes on, I would say protein has been something that people get processed carbohydrates. So protein is very important to make sure you get, you know, when you combine the rice with the beans and you get all the amino acids your body needs to build. So now it has the building blocks to create everything in the body, from your hair, skin, nails, enzymes, muscle fibers. I mean, you name it. Neurotransmitters for your brain to work and signal pathways. I mean, they are the building blocks to everything. So protein is very important. So if there's anything to make sure you get, it's the protein. You can get those from the beans. When you combine it with a bread, a grain, a rice, bulgur, anything like that, barley, spelt, there's so many grains. So what other grains? Quinoa has fiber and protein in it. So any kind of grain and bean is a really easy way to get your good nutrition in. And then you can add whatever you have available. You know, every culture has their own spice rack, you know, whatever's available indigenous to that area. So whatever there's on hand is going to help add a flavor to them. And then whatever fat you have available, you know, if it's olive oil, if it's, you know, happens to be lard from your, you know, from your other animals, whatever fat you have on hand is going to, you know, be something you can cook it with to add flavor. And so it doesn't burn the water, that kind of thing. So those are, can be a staple. And there's so many kinds of beans. So, you know, you don't have to get bored with the same one. It's actually better to diversify your food anyway. So that's something I would say keep on hand. And then the other thing is I would say canned, you know, tuna, sardines. You do want to be careful of the tuna because if it's not from clean sources, you know, being it's a bigger fish, it can have some mercury in it. And that's a concern for toxicity. Mercury builds up in the body, can be a poison. However, listen to this beautiful thing. Garlic and cilantro help bind mercury. So you see how adding different things to the food help nutritionally, not only with flavoring, but in health benefits. So that's something I just love. And then, you know, something like keeping those staples that we talked about earlier, if you can keep anything pickled on hand, olives, whatever is indigenous to your area. Something I wanted to mention that I think is fascinating is foraging. I absolutely love, love, love this. And I want to start, you know, being more aware of this myself. I remember growing up, you know, laughing at my mom and going, "Mom, stop embarrassing us. Wherever we go, you pick grass." And little did I know she was picking like the most, you know, potent, amazing greens, super greens. I had no clue what the heck she was picking. Like I took it for granted. You know, when you're a kid, you don't really get things. It's not until I got older did I realize, you know, or even recently, wow, what she was picking is this and this and this. And I made the connections. I went, oh my gosh, this is medicine. You know, if we can learn to look in your backyard and just see what do you have, you might be surprised that super greens you have available to you in your backyard. I mean, literally, people don't even know that they have things like purslane in their backyard. You know,
what is that?
Purslane, it's a super green. Most people take it for granted and probably step right over it. You'll find it in cracks.
Okay.
In cracks growing or, you know, randomly as a weed, and it's a super green. Do not throw that away. So I would challenge you to pick one new edible weed to eat. And I guarantee you, you will find it and be so shocked that you have plenty to live off of. It's quite amazing to me. There's so many things. I remember my mom, you know, picking grape leaves before their grapevine was developed, you know, that we would go places and she just picked grape leaves and they stuffed these grape leaves with, you know, either a rice and meat filling or a vegan version and then cooked them. And, you know, like olive oil and lemon juice. And they're phenomenal. My kids' favorite food is stuffed grape leaves. So that's a food that's very popular, you know, in the Middle East, among Syrians, Lebanese, Greeks, you know, the whole region over there. That's a very popular food item. And, you know, watercress. I remember going down, my dad will take us for, you know, an evening, a weekend day trip to like the river nearby, a park with a river. And my parents are picking watercress. And I couldn't believe, what are they picking out of this river? You know, here's watercress. You know, just things like that, that are readily available that we just take for granted because we're so used to things being in a package that we don't recognize it out of the package.
I love that. I love that so much. And I agree with you. I think there's such a wealth and abundance of natural food and properties around us that we can use to help our bodies and heal our bodies. And we just need to open our eyes. But I think it's also make sure that you are getting exactly what it is that you intend to get. Because if you don't properly identify something, you could harm yourself. So just make sure it is 100% what it is that you're intending.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. You do want to make sure that, you know, your experience, you're learning from someone who's experienced, you know, you've studied it, or there's an app now where you can download, take a picture and identifies the plant for you, which I'm sorry, I think I deleted that app, but there is an app like that. So there's one more thing I wanted to mention that I thought was phenomenal, because I remember in 10th grade high school, I did a demonstration speech where I showed people how to prepare this. So it's foreshadowing, right? It's so funny. Dandelion greens. How many people see dandelion greens places? And granted, you know, you question, did some a dog poop on it? You question, was there fertilizer on it? Or are there chemicals on it? You know, you kind of question if it's random places, what's on it? So that's the other concern, depending on where you find these things, you know? But, you know, in general, like the dandelion greens are pretty much everywhere. So if it's in a place where you trust where you're picking it, those are potent, potent detoxifiers.
So you're talking about the leaves of the yellow dandelion plant.
Correct. The green leaves. Correct. So what we grew up doing is my mom would boil them, squeeze the water out, and add garlic, lemon juice, and olive oil with salt. And that's it.
Wow.
And that's such a potent and tasty, that was another thing I just loved to eat. And it's a potent detoxifier. So what does that mean? Well, really quickly, a quick lesson. The job of the liver is huge. It has many, many, many functions. In school, when in doubt, the answer was the liver, because that's how much it did. So the liver's job is to cleanse the body from toxins. This is very important in this day and age. Why? Because we are inundated with toxins. So it is very important. The liver has a big job to do, and things that can detoxify it, like cruciferous vegetables, which includes sauerkraut, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, bok choy, garlic. What did I just talk about? Dandelion. All these things naturally detoxify the liver. They're super, super duper important. People are getting inflammatory conditions because their liver is so, so stressed. There's too many people with liver conditions that do not drink. So it's not cirrhosis. It's not related to hepatitis C. It's just liver, fatty liver disease. It's an overworked liver. So detoxification is very important for health. And these greens are super greens. They naturally do it.
Yeah, that's incredible. We could talk all day long about this stuff. I mean, this is like incredible, incredible information. I am so appreciative, really. Thank you so much for joining us again and coming back on today and talking to the audience about all this incredible information. And I know there's probably like so much more we could talk about. And I would like to have you come back onto the show at some point and take a deeper dive around some of the inflammation topic that we were talking about earlier. And just getting more of a robust conversation around what foods and how we can address it in some of these other areas. So if you would love to come back on, I'd love to have you.
I'd love to be back. This is such a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's always fun to chat with you. Thank you.
Absolutely. So sorry, we have to wrap it up for now, but we will definitely get back together and do another topic around all these questions that people have. And if you're listening right now and you have any questions that you might want to ask Claudia, in a future episode. You can always email at retreattopeacellc at gmail.com, and we can field those questions and get more information around answering that and getting it on the show for you. So thank you so much, Claudia. Thank you for listening. You know, in my audience, we are trying to get as much information out to you to really help you and really get you grounded as far as getting in a space that you can really live in your authentic space and really be at peace. I know these are unsettling times. So this is Catherine Daniels with Retreat to Peace, reminding you to live your authentic life with peace. And as always, retreat to peace. And we'll see you next time.